What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
China has issued a WTO obligation report for the first time. In it, China has slammed U.S. unilateralism and bullying moves. It has cited frequent U.S. breaches of WTO rules and obligations over the years, which included the U.S. guilty of pursuing an America First policy since the year 2017 at the expense of other countries. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether other nations that have been impacted will rise up, and if the U.S. will be held responsible for the abuse of WTO rules, while looking at examples of how the U.S. has executed illegal trade practices. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Ray McGovern joins us. He's a former CIA analyst who joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Also joining us is William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief of the Executive Intelligence Review, who joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Ray McGovern. So it's called the catchy title, I guess, Overall Assessment on the U.S. Compliance with its WTO Obligations, issued by China, that says basically frequent U.S. breaches of WTO rules over the years. Before we get into it, I'm curious as to whether the U.S. is going to be held accountable and what kind of punishment would the U.S. encounter. Because I'm guessing that if there are rules that are based from the WTO, that there should be accountability if the rules are being broken.
There surely should be. There very seldom are. These rules are made to be circumvented, or literally circumvented, or broken. It's the rules-based order that counts. And in that respect, the U.S. makes the rules, and they're trying to base them on people like China and others. The hypocrisy here on many things, including things like events in the Taiwan Straits or military activity near Alaska now. You have the U.S. complaining bitterly about 11 warships from Russia as well as China going near Alaska, and it's as though there aren't many, many more warships going near Taiwan, going near China. The Global Times, I don't know if you can see this here, but had a wonderful cartoon about the two-faced nature of all this, where one side is looking, hey, this is very provocative going near Alaska, and the other side is saying, freedom of navigation right up to the Chinese territorial waters. So the world can see this for what it is. These rules were helpful until the United States, in the first instance, tried to just get rid of them in favor of something never defined. You can't find it on Google, the rules-based international order.
Well, William Jones, one of the references that was made in this report said that the U.S. stands accused of pursuing an America First policy since the year 2017. Now, if we take a look at that, I mean, that's something that I believe, was the cornerstone of the former U.S. President Donald Trump. So that shouldn't be a surprise. I mean, that's what Donald Trump pursued. But yet China has mentioned this, which came at the expense of other countries, and that makes it obviously a lot heavier. Why do you think this was mentioned in this report? What was in the thinking of China?
Well, obviously, they want to point up the wrongful attitude of the United States in regard to what is supposed to be a somewhat egalitarian system in the WTO, and they pointed out to Trump in particular. But in fact, that America First policy has really been the policy of the United States since the fall of the Soviet Union. Trump made it into a bannerhead issue for his campaign, his presidency. But that's really been the attitude of the United States. That is, that at the point that the Soviet Union collapsed, they were the single superpower, and they made the decision that they intend to remain that. That's the basic problem we have here. What the Chinese have done with this devastating indictment of the U.S. and breaking the rules of the WTO, which the United States has itself been instrumental in creating, I think has sent a very clear signal to most of the other countries, especially in the global south, because the violations and the restrictions that the United States and the go-arounds that the United States has been doing with regard to China, they've also been doing with regard to the rest of the world, so that the other countries will feel sympathy to the issue, and I think it will be a kind of a rallying cry, not so much simply for abiding by WTO rules. The WTO was never a really equal and just system. It was created largely with the influence of the United States and largely as a result of the interests of the international financial oligarchy. So it's not a perfect system, but it was supposed to be somewhat egalitarian, that each country had the right to trade and to invest. And of course, that's been violated. But I think the result will be not that simply there will be a reform of the World Trade Organization, but that the countries of the global south, now with a significant amount of power that they didn't have previously, we'll be talking about new institutions of governance to with regard to trade and investment.
All right. You know what's very interesting, Ray McGovern, is the way that this has been described in the media. You have the one version on the America First, for example, just as an example, where it says the report accuses the U.S. of pursuing an America First policy since 2017 at the expense of other countries, which has also severely violated WTO core values and principles. That's one description. Then you have this. The U.S. rampant hegemonic moves that prioritize America First interests at the cost of ruining the world multilateral order and triggering chaos and division. Which version do you think is the case?
Can I say both? The second, of course, is just much more blatant and more detailed, so to speak. The question really needs to be looked at in a broader perspective. We're talking about trade. When I was analyzing for the CIA the relationship between Russia and China at a time when they hated each other, let's say 1964, the trade turnover was $200 million, a drop in the bucket. This year, the trade turnover is $200 billion with a B, okay? Now, I think that's a 1,000% increase. So the world has changed here, where China and Russia, Russia has turned to China rather than to Europe, and the U.S. no longer has this hegemonic ability to do these things. Now, the thing that worries me is that the U.S. still has the hegemonic ability to say these things. People often ask me, does Biden really believe that the U.S. still can call the shots around the world? And, you know, I used to say, I don't know, but now I can say pretty conclusively, yes, he still believes that. How do you know that, McGovern? He was speaking at a small dinner kind of thing in Maine after some campaign speeches just 2 weeks ago, okay? And he said, you know, the American president has the has the ability to put all this together, to put a world order together. Who else can do this but America? And then he cited Madeleine Albright, who famously said, the U.S. is the indispensable country. So what is Biden thinking here? He's completely behind the times. And what he doesn't realize is that he's driven China and Russia together in the kind of alliance, including a military alliance, if push comes to shove, that America, even Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski warned against. That's the real state of affairs. The problem is Biden doesn't seem to get it, and neither do his acolytes.
Indeed. Well, we need to get some terminologies, I think, into our discussion here, if you agree. And let me just list a few that was cited in this report, William Jones. I'm looking at, what is it saying here? Blocking appointments to the WTO appellate body, leading to his paralysis, abusing trade remedies and export controls, economic coercion and sanctions. Can you lay that out for us in layman terms so we can make sense out of it?
Well, effectively, the United States, according to the WTO, there is a judicial mechanism to decide disputes between countries, and there will always be disputes between countries with regard to trade and the like. And the U.S., of course, was instrumental in setting that up. And there are three judges who make that decision. There have been many attempts to appoint judges, none of which have been favorable, or none of which with the United States considered favorable enough to their interest to see elected, so that they simply use their veto power to prevent a judge from being elected. And therefore, that appellate jurisdiction, that group, is essentially paralyzed at this point. The other things are simply a result of, I know that Ray often talks about American exceptionalism. That's the basic problem. So what you have are sanctions. Sanctions are generally imposed by the United Nations. They're accepted. Those sanctions are accepted by all nations that are part of the United Nations. The United States uses unilateral sanctions. It uses sanctions as a weapon. That's one of the things that they're doing. The other thing are the restrictions, institution of tariffs in order to penalize, not in order to protect, but to penalize China. It's really economic warfare against the People's Republic of China that we're seeing today. And that's a part of the message that the U.S. has been sending. And I think what China has pointed out to are the various aspects, the various items that they have been using, short of war, short of military conflict, in order to weaken China, to reduce its capability of supporting its own population, and in particular to reduce its capability of moving ahead scientifically. This is what the United States wants to stop, because they feel that it's going to be a threat to them. So this is really the essence of that that policy, is to try and point out how the United States is using the so-called economic power of that American exceptionalism in order to conduct an economic warfare against China.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
There's a lot to talk about when it comes to the use of sanctions, but I think a lot of it has been already said. I'm sure there's newer things maybe to be said on that front, Ray McGovern, if you have anything to add to that. But my question comes as to some of the bans that the U.S. has exercised when it comes to things like ZTE equipment sales. I'm looking at Huawei is another one. And also the chips, the use of chips, the investment even in chips, the investment in China overall, where the U.S. has actually is trying to dissuade companies, encouraging them from leaving China. This affects other countries around the world, doesn't it?
It does. But the primary interest here, I think, is the U.S.-Chinese bilateral relationship. Now, as soon as Biden took office, he sent his two acolytes, sophomores at the time, they're rising juniors now, Blinken and Sullivan, to Anchorage to meet with Chinese officials at the very top level, okay? And what did they do? They treated them like the British imperialists used to treat the Chinese as they drove gunboats up the Yangtze River. That's what they say. You got to do this, you got to do that, and we have this order that we're imposing. And after they came back, after this debacle, Biden got up in a major speech. I want to quote him. He said, China wants to become the wealthiest and the most powerful country in the world, but that, quote, is not going to happen on my watch, end quote. No, he's delusional. He has no way to stop this, short of war, okay? The other thing I would point out is that the Chinese don't have to be paranoid about this. They know about the yellow peril. They know about U.S. racism. They know, in my view, that the U.S. would not have dropped atomic bombs on people who look like me, okay? They know that Ukrainians consider the Russians inferior people, Untermenschen. They know that the Poles consider the Ukrainians Untermenschen. So where does that leave the Chinese? That leaves them in a very delicate place because they are going to become the most powerful country in the world. That is inevitable. What are these delusional U.S. policymakers going to do to try to stop it?
All right. Next up, I'm sorry if this is a report that China came out, so I shouldn't apologize. But we're going after the U.S. That's what the report did. For example, this, I think, is very important, how the U.S. has abused national security, human rights, and forced technology transfer as excuses to take unilateral measures against other WTO members. How important is that one, William Jones?
That's really the key to the whole thing. This is particularly the so-called national security exceptions, using the pretext that certain goods cannot be exported to China, which is considered a rival because of the danger to national security. Now, this has been expanded just beyond any belief. Obviously, a lot of things that are produced in the economy are dual use. You can use them to, heal the sick, or you can use them to build weapons. And that therefore, by expanding this, you are essentially introducing a policy of what I would call technological apartheid. That is the attempt to restrict China from access to the basic high-tech machinery and equipment that they need to move forward. Now, as Ray indicated, this is a losing game because the Chinese have now, 400 million people or more in their middle class. They are organized on developing science and technology. The whole country is like one big Manhattan Project in pushing the frontiers of science. They will get, if they're restricted from some things, they will begin to make them themselves. The problem is that by making China an enemy, by imposing this so-called technological apartheid, you are making it almost impossible for China, which is bending over backwards, has been bending over backwards to have a good relationship with the United States, to work with a country that has shown so much mistrust and so much lying and cheating, as is indicated in this report, that it will be difficult to come together. That is going to be the biggest loss for the world. And hopefully there will be a change of heart in the United States as people begin to see that we are in crisis, not China, as Biden said the other day, that it's a ticking time bomb because it's going to be an economic crisis. We're the ones that have the crisis, not the Chinese. And Biden just hasn't understood this, in spite of the fact of what's happening with the dollar today and what's happening in the national markets, in the stock markets and elsewhere. Things are going downhill here quickly, and he's just blind to that fact, maybe because of his age, maybe for other simply ideological reasons. But that's the problem. I think others will understand at some point that this is a not a workable solution, and they've got U.S. has got to change tack and move in a different direction.
When are others going to not only understand it, which I'm sure they do, Murray McGovern, but they're going to stand up? I mean, in the case of China, our guest there says, well, China has been bending over backwards. And I think you said, Ray McGovern, if I'm correct, to have understood you in your last statements or previous statements, that there's one way to stand up to this, and that is to take the military route. If I was correct to understand you that way, how can either China or other countries stand up to what the U.S. is doing then?
Well, the key, of course, is Ukraine. And the Russians are about to win the battle on the ground. The question is whether the U.S. will widen the sphere of this conflict. And in that case, China can be depended upon, in my view, to saber-rattle in the Far East and perhaps do even more. China knows that it's next in line after NATO does in the Soviet Union, Russia. One last point here. You know, when push does come to shove and Americans realize what has been done in their name, I think they'll be amenable to a live and let live sort of attitude toward China. I mean, after all, the Chinese have said, hey, well, how about a win-win? How about, there are enough resources in the world. How about we share them and not try to prevent us, Chinese, from sharing in them in a prosperous way? I think Americans will be able to appreciate that, but it will take a rather traumatic turnaround, and I think, and I'm afraid, that's coming in the United States.
All right, very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for your comments. William Jones there, Washington Bureau Chief of the Executive Intelligence Review. Ray McGovern, thank you. Former CIA analyst from Raleigh, North Carolina. Thank you to you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. It's goodbye until the next program.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, sisters and brothers from all around the world, from every single corner of this world. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is IRIB English Radio, and I'm Asma as your host. Once more, I have the pleasure to be here with Brother Mustafa and Brother Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Oh, well, I'd like it if you introduce yourself briefly.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. So my name is Sayyid Abdullah al-Musawi, teacher, student, seeker, preacher of Islamic knowledge in general.
Yeah. And you, Brother Mustafa?
My name is Sayyid Mustafa. I am a student here and I'm studying psychology.
Well, very good. So there is this controversial debate over the issue of hijab, over this topic. And I guess everybody is so concerned about whether it is a sign of freedom for women or no, it's the opposite, or just things like that. As a woman, I would say that hijab is the thing that is going to keep your dignity. And at the same time, it would improve your character in the eyes of other people. Because then by wearing hijab, you're just saying that you're not just something so easily to be achieved. Something that could be easily achieved or something that is available in all the communities and things like that. So Now, I am so sure that as men, you are going to have your own ideas upon that. So?
Sure. So the topic brings about a quote from Imam Khomeini to mind, which is, he said that if women knew how men look at them, then they would leave the house wearing steel armor. Okay. That's what he said.
Nice.
Okay. That's one thing. You know, you have to understand that the way you dress, it has an impact on society. It's not so simple. I can dress however I want. And, you know, if you go to the bank or if you go to the office, you expect people to wear formal dresses,
yeah.
Right? If you see someone there sitting in shorts and like slippers, it's going to have an impact on you. You're going to be like, what is this? You know, what's going on?
Yeah.
Is this like casual day today? Or
where am I going?
Yeah. Or if, let's say, the police is wearing a uniform,
mm-hmm.
it's to symbolize their authority. So how we dress has an impact. And of course, hijab is a big, big part of it. It has a huge impact on the person's social security as well as their individual security. I definitely agree with that. I can elaborate more on that if you wish. But yeah, that's sort of
okay,
my
initial
stance.
Okay, let's have Brother Abdullah's idea
stance.
And then we'd be back.
Now, I myself, I have immense, beyond comprehension, respect for women who wear the hijab and the ones who wear it proper. And I have like admiration actually for them, especially the ones that wear the correct, proper hijab, because it is, from where I stand, it's not an easy thing to
exactly.
do.
Exactly.
And especially in summer. In summer, every time I see a woman, I genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, I pray for her and for her safety, because she has to go through all the clothing and all the abba and, you know, and
yeah.
the heat, and the black attracts the heat. And
a lot to go through.
Yeah. So I genuinely pray for them. Now, the concept of hijab itself as a concept, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, obviously, when he created different genders, he created them with different qualities and different aspects and different nature. Now, the woman in her nature, she's delicate, she's beautiful, she's gentle, and all these things. And men in their nature, the vicious, they're, you know, like Khomeini said, like the brother said, Mustafa. So they need, you know, it requires, herself requires protection. And her beauty requires protection, and her everything about her requires protection. And also the man himself requires protection. I think Sayyid Khamenei, he had a saying along this way. He said, when you wear a hijab, it's not just for your safety, it's for the safety of others as well. So it's for the safety of men as well. It's for the safety of families as well. I mean, you as a wife, for example, you wouldn't want your husband to be tempted by other women, would you? I mean, the more unclothed they are, don't have hijab, the more your husband or your son will deviate.
The families are prone to some problems.
Yeah, so hijab is not only a protection for the individual himself, rather it's a protection for the entire society.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? When we look at hijab as just a personal choice, as something that you should do between you and God, then obviously we miss the point, and then that's how corruption happens. So it's and like I said, it's not an easy, and I think it's one of the hardest tests that a woman has to go through in her life to wear the hijab, because she needs to understand the concept of it first and foremost. So this is how I see the hijab. Hijab is a protection for the entire society rather than for an individual.
Well, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. So stay tuned. I always say that women are just like these valuable pearls, that when they wear hijab, it's as if they're putting themselves, this valuable pearl of them, of their soul, into this shell to protect themselves. So yes, this is Back to Reality. I'm Asma, and Brother Mustafa and Brother Abdullah are here to help us with the topic. I know it might sound so weird because men are talking about the issue that is related to women.
That's what I disagree with, that it's not just about women.
Mm-hmm.
Hijab is not just about women.
Yeah, but they are the ones who are doing,
That's what I'm saying. That's misunderstanding of our perception of what hijab is.
Mm-hmm.
Hijab isn't just about a piece of cloth covering
yeah.
yourself or just a woman. It's a philosophy, it's an attitude, it's a way of behaving.
It's true, I admit. But there are people out there who would say that, okay, Why should I go through the terrible because of the benefit of someone else?
Well, what we're saying is not just benefiting someone else. It's benefiting you first and foremost. Mm-hmm. It's benefiting you the most, right?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you could wear the hijab. It may not change how men look at you, by the way, right? But it does offer you protection, correct? And secondly, you're not realizing maybe, I think women don't realize how men are looking at them despite sometimes being married to men. I think they need to realize how men are and what their perception is of women in society. And let me back that up by saying that, you know, this is kind of a sensitive topic in the sense that if you look at psychology today and the people that are coming to psychologists and the type of problems that they're coming with, unfortunately today, one of the biggest illnesses, mental illnesses, is related to sex and sexuality. And that goes back to hijab. Hijab is there to protect society from these kind of illnesses.
Yeah.
If you go to Western societies where they have all this freedom and you can, you know, basically be nude and do whatever you want, please go and study also what kind of mental illnesses they have in terms of related to sex and sexuality. Today, children at the age of 6 and 7 have sexual illnesses. Why is that happening? So hijab isn't just a very simple issue about whether you're putting on a cloth. It relates to your entire behavior, your family life. It's a much deeper topic than just mm-hmm. you walking out in society and covering your head, you know?
Yeah.
That's how I see it.
So if you want to talk to your daughter and convince her that hijab is going to protect you, and she's a sort of a girl who is not easy to be submissed to something, how would you justify her?
Okay, so the first thing that the backbone of everything is knowledge, is understanding. So the I think I had a girl once, she called me and she was discussing the concept of hijab. She wasn't really accepting. So the first thing I said to her, you're a Muslim, right? She said, yes. So she was doubting the concept of hijab, whether Allah in the Quran said so yeah. or not. Khimar, what does khimar mean? And, you know, all the things that they hear mm-hmm. on TED Talks and all that nonsense. So I said to her, well, do you pray? She's like, yeah. I said, do you fast? She's like, yeah. I said, did you ever doubt that Salah is not in the Quran or fasting is not in the Quran? She's like, no. I said, but God did not explain anything about Salah. Neither, nor Siyam. He said, fast and he did not say anything else. Did you ever doubt it? She's like, no. So I said to her, why are you doubting hijab then? Is it the problem that you're having? Is it a personal thing that you don't like? Or is it that Allah did not say so? She's like, no, okay. Well, okay, fine. God says mm-hmm. so. Then it's something with me. So it's okay. Then let's leave God alone. Let's say it is there. But I don't like it. Now, why don't I like it? Why aren't I wearing the hijab? That's the question. So obviously it's a personal conflict between me and hijab.
Yeah.
With Allah. So I don't want to submit to Allah. That's one thing. So then again, you have to understand that it's a law from Allah. Now, the amazing thing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or even in life, the best things in life, the most sacred things in life are the ones that no one can touch, the ones that are covered, right? So, for example, like you began with the cake, for example, or the chocolate, it's got a wrapping, a diamond, it's got a casing. And the most valuable the thing is, the more protection it has, mm-hmm. because you don't want anything, you don't want any fingertips and fingerprints on it. Hijab is not only protection, but it's also a beauty. It's a symbol of your iffah, it's a symbol of your chastity, it's a symbol of your submission to Allah subhanahu
exactly.
wa ta'ala. And also, it's a symbol of your representation of Islam as well. So mm-hmm. when a person sees a Muslim woman with a hijab, she's not only representing herself, not only representing her faith, but she's representing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala too. And lastly, women are the delicate creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right?
Yeah.
And Allah said, this is my creation, and don't you dare approach them. You constantly, like, directly going to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's not easy.
Yeah.
Right? So this is so how we shift our attention, because sometimes we just look at it from a religious perspective, halal, haram, fiqh-wise. Did Allah say so? No, there's more to hijab than meets the eye.
Mm-hmm.
That's whether we're looking at it from a psychological perspective, philosophical perspective. But at the end of the day, this is how I simply see it. Women are the creation of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He loves them so much. He wants them protected, and he put that protection around them because he doesn't want people approaching them.
He doesn't want people insulting them. He doesn't want people objectifying them. Now, when I see a woman who's on the street without a hijab, with the clothes, what am I going to do? Respect her or objectify her? I'm going to look at her as an object for my own satisfaction. That's the reality of things, right? This is what men do. You see a woman without hijab, she's an object for your desires. And women lowered themselves to that standard.
Let's go for a short break and then you can elaborate that.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're back, and this is Back to Reality. And the last part, we don't have too much of time.
Sure. I think we ended with why are people behaving in certain ways. And I think ultimately, it's all, if I were to maybe make the discussion more meta, I would say, why are people doing any sin, for example, or doing any kind of behavior? I think with a hijab, it's very easy, right? It's a, like we were talking, I think, in another discussion, like there's an automatic reaction, right? When we are faced with a certain situation where it's an automatic physical chemical reaction, we all understand this, right? And we now need to realize, how is that impacting the rest of our lives, correct?
Yeah.
So in societies where it's a very materialistic, or there's no hijab or soul freedom, what you realize is people are extremely, extremely distracted, right? All of these things, like music, if we were talking about music or any other sort of Islamic, you know, injunction, it's taking you towards, it's taking you away from all the distractions. It's allowing you to focus on being successful in your life.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's what, for example, hijab does, or any other Islamic obligation, is to help human beings be successful in their lives.
And be at an more individual focused. Level.
Yeah. All of these sins will distract you. And ask any youth today, what is your biggest issue or biggest problem? And it will be something to do with marriage or, you know, girls or something to do with this. It's a big distraction in today's life and we need a way to deal with it. And hijab is one way to deal with these problems.
Yeah, one great way, I suppose. So, yes. Brother Abdullah, your final words.
This is a personal
point of view.
So I can't say this is how Islam is or how men are.
Yeah.
Me, the more covered the woman is, the more beautiful she is.
Yeah.
The more, she, even if she covers her entire face, to me.
Well, although I'm not the kind of person who would say that the women who are practicing hijab would not face any limitation or things like that, because There might be some limitations for you as the person who covers herself. But since you're doing that out of love for your Lord, out of love for the one who is the closest of all to you, so I guess taking all the terrible would be worth it. Yes, this was all. I hope you enjoyed it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabbal Alameen. يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة لتصي دليلتك Once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters. Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States' intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted, and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election. Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like crying wolf. How many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through. And I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's four indictments which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, you know, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
On the 17th anniversary of the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah underlined the prospects of the resistance front in the entire region.
I do not deny, as the Israeli war minister threatened, that they can take Lebanon back to the Stone Age. But I tell our enemy, based on evidence and facts, you also will be taken to the Stone Age. If you choose to go to war with Lebanon, you will be returned to the Stone Age. Our enemy can make a list of civilian and military obvious infrastructure in the area of occupied Palestine. They can calculate how many rockets the resistance needs to destroy all of these sites.
The Hezbollah leader stressed that the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the Resistance Alliance of the region have seized the initiative to a very high extent.
August 14, 2006, did not only signal the end of 33 days of Israeli hostilities, but it ushered in a new phase in the Israeli-Arab conflict. For the first time since its creation, Israel has been deterred from launching a new aggression for 17 years.
Western and Israeli reports published since the end of the 2006 war and until today mentioned that Hezbollah had a decisive victory over Israel with a lasting impact.
Any Western who was has a freedom or was liberal to say the truth would do nothing but acknowledge the truth about the resistance and honor them, because in their books and their reports they acknowledge that those people performed very highly and they were not scared, and they were facing the tanks and the airplanes and all of this with their humble weapons. But as the other brother said, but they had a spirit that the Israeli will never have, because they're fighting for good cause.
Observers believe the war has set the cornerstone for a new age for the peoples of this region and the whole world.
What this victory has done to the mentalities is building a new way of thinking, way of victorizing against the enemies, especially the West and its culture. They cannot invade us again.
Israel's aggression killed around 1,300 Lebanese, mostly civilians. It destroyed thousands of residential buildings and houses and severely damaged Lebanese civil infrastructure and displaced approximately 1 million Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Mlita, South Lebanon.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. people only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least three times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Afghan women's restaurant is situated in the capital, Kabul, and serves traditional Afghan food. The restaurant is decorated with colorful fabrics, handicrafts, and flowers, and it is known for being run by and for women. The owners say it is a safe haven for women who want to enjoy a meal, socialize, and express themselves freely.
This restaurant is established to serve and help women. All of our employees and customers are women. We wanted to create a space where women can feel comfortable and hopeful and enjoy tasty Afghan traditional food. It's also aimed at offering jobs to women who are left without an income.
The women who work at the facility say they started working here after the Taliban banned them from other jobs and education. They call on the de facto government to reverse the restrictions on women's rights.
I was a student of law when the Taliban enforced the ban on universities. At the time, I felt so bad and depressed. In addition, our family was running out of money. Then I decided to join this restaurant. It is very beneficial and helpful for me. I call on the Taliban to restore our rights to work and education.
The restaurant is popular among women who come here to enjoy the food and the atmosphere. The customers say they appreciate the service and the solidarity that they find here.
I am a 12th grade student. I visit this restaurant because it is run by and for women. I come here to study, have Afghan hand-baked food, and socialize with my friends. I also want to meet new people and chat with them. I'm happy that at least we have this opportunity and service.
The restaurant is a rare example of women's empowerment and resistance in a country where the Taliban have imposed strict restrictions on women's rights. Despite the challenges and risks, Afghan women are not giving up on their dreams and aspirations. They're supportive of each other in the face of the imposed restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Seventy-five years after the forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries.
UNRWA's financial crisis started since signings of the Oslo Accord. It is mainly a political crisis, not financial, aroused by the U.S. administrations and the EU. The crisis is worsening every year, especially in Gaza. The donor countries have defunded and stopped their aids.
Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services.
After my father's passing, I continue to live with the same suffering. The UNRWA's food supplies are not sufficient anymore. I beg my neighbors to feed us because I can't support my family. I can't work due to the health issues. My wife is also ill, and the UNRWA's medical centers, which are responsible for providing health care to us, don't provide her with the medications needed.
Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatim is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.
The politicization of the Palestinian refugees' plight jeopardizes the lives of over 1.2 million people in the Gaza Strip. The international community must shoulder their responsibilities towards the Palestinian refugees who were forcibly displaced from their original lands. Palestinian refugees continue to suffer since they were displaced back during the Nakba in 1948 by the Israeli occupation. The current UNRWA's financial crisis is harming thousands of Palestinian refugee families in Gaza, whose only hope is not to go hungry. Al Al-Asib, Gaza.
The 15th Iran-South Africa Joint Commission in Pretoria has wrapped up with 26 cooperation agreements drafted and waiting to be finalized when Iran's president travels to South Africa later in autumn. Another sign of growing ties between the two countries that already enjoy close relations and have always supported each other during hard times.
One of the duties of Iran-South Africa Joint Commission is to come up with solutions to help establish peace and prosperity for nations in Africa and Asia. Moreover, we have high hopes for the outcome and achievements of this commission meeting in enhancing bilateral relations.
The Joint Economic Commission has proven to be more than just that, with shared views on international developments, which confirm Iran's foreign minister's comments when he said great steps have been taken to consolidate relations in various areas. But considering the geopolitical position of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of South Africa, with Iran eyeing a BRICS membership, it seems that the commonalities might lead to stronger relations than what has been defined by the Joint Commission. Ties that may transcend the realms of bilateral cooperation in a world where more and more countries have expressed their frustration with Western hegemony and U.S. unilateralism.
Dear Minister, you know we are important members of what is termed the Global South. Both our countries are members of the Non-Aligned Movement. Our two nations support multilateralism and thus appreciate the role of the United Nations as the premier multilateral institution, while also advocating strongly for the reform of the United Nations, particularly the role and composition of the United Nations as Security Council.
With the Iranian president expected to pay two separate visits to South Africa, one to attend the BRICS Plus summit on August 24th and another to finalize the 26 cooperation agreements that were drafted by the 15th Joint Commission, prospects of a significant alliance are now stronger than ever. South Africa is considered an important country of the African continent, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has enjoyed warm relations with this country for decades. Now the Raisi administration wants these relations to go to the next level, achieving their full potential, all in line with a new multipolar world order that is emerging. Kisumi Shahmadi, Pretoria.
leader meets with commanders and crew of 86th Flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy.